when you do one of the deity practices, then you really get some feeling for a different state of mind, or how it's possible to have a different kind of body, a body made of light, or and how it's possible maybe to have a different facial expression than you're used to having. You imagine yourself having the facial expression of Chenrezig or Manjushri, for example. So all of this gives us some inspiration and some hints about the potential of our mind and how our mind can be transformed. And thank goodness the Buddha set out that path for mental transformation. He told us how to go from A to B. And now it's up to us to put what the Buddha taught into practice. And so they say the cream of all the Buddha's teachings, the kind of the really delicious part, is the bodhicitta, the aspiration for full awakening for the benefit of all beings. We generate that aspiration based on having renunciation or the aspiration for liberation for not only ourselves, but all living beings. And we aspire not simply for an arhat's liberation, but the liberation of a Buddha, where both obscurations have been eliminated. So based on that renunciation of samsara, we generate bodhicitta. And then based on the compassion and love and great resolve that precede the bodhicitta and the altruistic intention that is the bodhicitta, then we turn our minds to generate the correct view and the wisdom that realizes the nature of reality directly, because that is what will actually free us. So these three principal aspects of the path, the aspiration for liberation, bodhicitta, correct view, are related to each other. They help each other in the sense that the more we generate one, the more we can see how it helps us generate the other two. But still, the loving, compassionate thought of the bodhicitta is something quite special in there, because it's the property of only those who aspire for the full awakening of a Buddha. It's a trait of somebody who's really dedicated their lives to being of great benefit to others. And it's the quality of someone who has tremendous self-confidence, not in an egotistical way, but self-confidence that comes from having an inkling of their own Buddha nature, of their own potential, that can never be removed from them, that is part of the nature of the mind. So with that kind of self-confidence that enables us to have the great compassion and dedicate our lives for the benefit of others in the long term, then let's listen to teachings tonight to accumulate part of the merit, part of the wisdom that are necessary for full Buddhahood. So I'm working with the Kindle version. I forget what the page number is. What did you say?
107.
So where it says note well. Okay. So we've been talking about what a syllogism is, and then the three criteria. He called it three modes. I prefer three criteria because I don't know what a mode is. Okay, three criteria that show that we look for to see if a syllogism is valid for a particular person. Yeah, and so the first one is seeing if the reason is a property of the subject. The reason is the property of the subject. So that's the first one. And then the reason is pervaded by being the, what they call the similar class. In other words, the group of things that is the predicate, or said in simple ways, if it's the reason, then it is necessarily the predicate. So that's the second one, called the pervasion. And then the third one is the counter-pervasion, which means that the reason does not belong to the dissimilar class. In other words, if it is the reason, it is not the non-predicate. No. Yeah. Okay, or another way to say that is, if it's not the predicate, then it's not the reason. Okay, so if we look at, here he's giving the one of the sound being a product, but we had the one of the self is, what was it? The self was empty because it's a dependent arising. Was that the one we were using? The self is impermanent because it's a product. Okay. So what's the subject? What's the predicate? What's the reason? Product. What's the property? The showing that the reason is the property of the subject? Self is a product. Okay. What is it we're trying to prove in this syllogism? That the self is impermanent. Okay. So first we see the properties. The self is a product. What's the pervasion? If it's a product, it's necessarily impermanent. And the counter-pervasion? Yeah, if it's not impermanent, it's not a product. Okay, so when we had the classes up there, I had some little diagrams, but they're not here. But if you can imagine them, yeah. So for the property, you would have in this one product being like a circle, and the self being like a little dot in the circle, showing that, you know, the subject, the showing that the reason is a property of the subject. Okay, then the one showing the pervasion would be one of two kinds: either a big circle, which would be impermanent, that is also having another big circle the same size, which is product. So that's one way you can have the pervasion of, if it's a product, it's impermanent, in the sense that product and impermanent are equivalent. Yeah. Or another way that you could still have the pervasion is that the predicate, impermanent, is the big circle, and the reason product is a little circle inside of it. Okay, completely inside of it. So those two ways are the only way you could draw it for a pervasion to be correct. Okay. If the pervasion's correct, then the counter pervasion also is going to hold. Okay, because if you look at your diagram, okay, if it's two concentric circles, if it's not one of them, if it's not a member of one of them, it's not going to be a member of the other one either. Okay. Or if we look at the one with the big circle with the small circle inside of it, if it's not a member of the big circle, then it's definitely not going to be a member of the small circle either. Okay. So maybe draw these yourself. Because I find it, I don't know about you, but I find it very helpful to draw this. And it helps me to really see, you know, what am I trying to talk about here? Okay? So that's reviewing from last week. Yeah, I hope you read your notes and, you know, have some understanding. Okay, so I'll keep reading here. Because of the epistemological requirement of the first mode of the sign, that the sign is a fully qualified property of the subject only for someone who has definitely ascertained the quality of that sign as a property of that subject, that is, that sound is a product, there is an important restriction on how syllogisms may be formulated. He must be half Tibetan because the sentence is almost as long as a paragraph. But this is a short paragraph. Okay. What he's saying here is that it's not sufficient just that the syllogism is set up properly, you know, as an abstract syllogism, but that the syllogism relates to individuals, yeah? And an individual for whom the syllogism is going to be valid must be somebody who is seeking information about the subject, okay, and wants to know about the subject. And regarding the first criteria that the sign is a fully, that the sign is a quality of the subject, that person must understand that the sign is a quality of the subject. So that person must understand that the self is a product. Okay? If the person doesn't understand that the self is a product, you know, and it is produced by causes and conditions, if they don't understand that, then they're not going to understand the rest of the syllogism. Okay? So if you have somebody who believes in believes very strongly that there's a permanent soul, you know, that goes from one life to the next, or that exists in this life and goes to heaven or hell afterwards, if you have somebody that very firmly believes that, then they're not going to understand the first criteria of the syllogism. And so the whole syllogism isn't going to hold for them. And in fact, we can't say that they've understood that the property, that the sign is a property of the subject. Okay? So it has to be somebody who, you know, to understand that first criteria, who understands that. Yeah. And hearing this, I know really helped me, because when I was studying, nobody said that at the beginning. So I had this idea that just by setting out a syllogism, everybody should automatically understand it. Yeah. But that's not the case. Because people have different levels of understanding, different levels of knowledge, Okay? And so just setting out a syllogism doesn't mean that somebody has ascertained any of the three modes or any of the three criteria. Yeah. So that person, you know, here when I say understand, I mean ascertain. Ascertain means that you know with a reliable cognizer. In other words, it's not just an assumption. It's not just a guess. It's not just, well, my friend said so, so I believe, or the Buddha said so, so I believe. It's not just, well, yeah, maybe, sure. It's really understanding it, knowing that for sure that the property, that the reason is the property of the subject, okay? And in this case, that means knowing for sure that being a product is a property of the self. Yeah. So that's not always so easy, you know? That's probably why they give an example of sound. But of course, for people who were Brahmins who grew up with the idea that sound was permanent, because the sound of the Vedas was always happening, then because of growing up and having that idea very firmly implanted in them, even with the illustration of sound, it was probably very difficult for them to see sound as a product. You know, because when we learn certain ideas and we become familiar with them, even if they're incorrect, they can be hard to shake. These are examples of the acquired afflictions. Okay, they can be very difficult to shake because we're very familiar with them. Okay, for us, maybe understanding that sound is a product is easier because we see that when you hit that, you know, there's causes and conditions, and a sound is produced. Okay, so, you know, for that kind of thing, oh yeah, you hit the gong and it makes a sound, so the sound is a product of these causes and conditions. But it has to relate to a specific individual. Yeah, and that person has to get it. The restriction is that it cannot be a valid argument if there is the same thing in part two of the syllogism, the property of the subject, and part three, the sign. Part two of the syllogism. Yeah, it should be the predicate, isn't it? And part three, the sign. Okay. Yeah. This is because the four ascertainments must be done in sequence. The first criteria of the second sign, then the second criteria, then the third, and only then the ascertainment of the conclusion. If there's the same thing in both the predicate and the reason, then there's nothing to prove. So, yeah. For example, we can't say the subject sound or the subject, the self, is a product because of being a product. That doesn't make any sense, does it? Yeah. You can't prove something by saying it is that thing. Okay. Then when a person understands the property of the subject, that sound is the product, the person would have already understood the conclusion that sound is a product. Okay, so it is suitable to have the same thing in parts one and two, in other words, the subject and the predicate, or to have the same thing in parts one and three, but it does not work in parts two and three. It sounds kind of funny for our ears to hear, for instance. The subject, an impermanent phenomena, is an impermanent phenomena because of being a product. Okay, so that's an example where you have the same thing in one and two, but it sounds kind of funny. But That one still can be okay because we are talking about the subject and impermanent phenomena. However, remember from the description of statements of qualities in chapter 5, two kinds of statements, that not every phenomena exemplifies itself. For instance, remember this one? Definition is not a definition. Definition is a definiendum. It's something that is defined. Thus, the information that a thing exemplifies its own quality in the way that an impermanent phenomena is an impermanent phenomena may be new knowledge. Okay, so what he's saying here is that not every phenomena is a quality of itself. Okay, so definition isn't a definition. Yeah, why not? Because it's a definiendum. What? Give me an example of a definition. Well, give me an example of a definition and its definiendum. Okay, so what's the definition and what's the definiendum? Okay, so the definiendum is impermanent, changing moment by moment is its definition. Okay? So you can have many things that are definitions, but the word definition itself is not a definition. It's a thing that is defined by, you can look up in the dictionary what the definition of definition is. Okay, so he's saying here, you know, for somebody who is not aware that impermanent phenomena exemplifies itself, in other words, that impermanent phenomenon is an impermanent phenomena, then this syllogism may be new knowledge. Yeah.
Do you think the first impermanent phenomena is talking about the category impermanent phenomena, and the second one is talking about being a momentary phenomena?
Well, here he has the subject and impermanent phenomenon.
Yes.
They're talking about any impermanent phenomenon. Or it could be, you could say impermanent phenomena are, you know, are impermanent, impermanent phenomena is an impermanent phenomena. And there you would be talking about the category. So I think it could go either way.
So really this is saying the subject, a momentary phenomena is a momentary phenomena because of being a product. It's not talking about categories.
No, it could be talking about a category. The category impermanent phenomena, that category itself is an impermanent phenomena.
So you think that's what this is saying?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you. I just wanted to confirm.
Yeah. It could also be saying an impermanent phenomena, meaning that abstract, remember we talked about that before, that abstract singular, what does he call it? Singular abstract something. So it could also be that, you know, I think you could see it both ways. Okay. In summary, product is the property of the subject in the proof of sound as an impermanent phenomena by the sign product. Because of being ascertained, okay, as I'm going to skip the stuff in parentheses because it's true, but it takes us off in left field for a while. Okay, so in summary, product is the property of the subject in the proof of the self as an impermanent phenomena by the sign product because of being ascertained as only existing in accordance with the mode of statement with sound. Okay? That's strange language that's hard to understand. Okay? So, when it says it's only existing in accordance with the mode of statement is this is an is statement, not an exists statement. Okay, so it's saying one thing is another, not this exists because that exists. Okay? So it's an is statement. That's the mode of the statement. And only existing means that the subject, okay, the self or sound, is only a product. It's not, it's never a non-product. There's got to be an easier English way to say this. Okay, so the property of the subject in this syllogism is formulated, but we'll just use sound here, okay? Sound is a product, okay? So the actual property is the reason, which is product, okay? But it's formulated as sound is a product. Yeah. However, whatever is a property of sound is not necessarily suitable as a correct sign in the proof of sound as an impermanent phenomena because of the epistemological reasons given above concerning the person for whom the syllogism is stated and because of the requirements of the other two modes of a correct sign, the forward privation and the counter privation. Okay, so what it's saying here is that whatever is a property of sound, for example, loud, is not necessarily suitable as a correct sign in that example. So you can't say, you know, the sound is impermanent because of being loud. It's true that being loud is a property of sound, but that doesn't work as a sign because it doesn't fulfill the privation and the counter-privation. That's what he's trying to say. Okay. In other words, not anything that is a property of sound can be used as the reason. Okay. Because the reason has to fulfill all three criteria. It can't just fulfill the first one. Okay, now forward privations. So the second criteria of a correct sound is the forward privation. Whereas the property of the subject is reckoned between the sign and the subject, in other words, it's showing a relationship between the sign and the subject, both of the required privations are reckoned between the sign and the predicate to be proven, also known as the predicate of the thesis. Okay, and this one is impermanent. More technically, in the case of the forward privation, it is a relationship between the sign and the similar class. The similar class is the basis of relation of the forward privation, just as the subject is the basis of relation of the property of the subject. Okay, so remember in all of these that the reason is the reason is the thing that fulfills all three criteria. In looking at the first criteria being the property of the subject, okay, it's the basis of that relationship is sound, and the property that you're showing is related to that is product. When we're doing the predicate, when we're doing the forward privation, the basis that we're talking about is impermanent, is the predicate, and we're showing how the sign relates to that predicate. Okay? So it's just and so here, the predicate is called the similar class. Yeah, what that means is when we say sound is impermanent because of being a product, impermanent or impermanent phenomena is, you know, it is the basis that we're looking at, and we're trying to show that if something is the reason, it is the predicate. If it's a product, then it is impermanent. Okay? So the similar class is everything that's impermanent. Yeah. Similar class just means everything that is the predicate. Okay? Everything that is a member of the class that the predicate is. Okay? So in this case, impermanent phenomena, this similar class is everything that's an impermanent phenomena. Okay? The dissimilar class means everything that isn't an impermanent phenomena. Okay? So everything that isn't an impermanent phenomena, that's the dissimilar class. And that could refer either to permanent phenomena, or it could refer to non-impermanent phenomena, which also includes non-existence. So there's two ways of talking about the dissimilar class. One way where you include non-existence, one way where you don't. I don't think it makes a big difference which way you put it. Okay, so in the proof of sound as an impermanent phenomena, the class of impermanent phenomena is the similar class. So that means the group of impermanent phenomena is the similar class. The definition of the similar class in the proof of sound as an impermanent phenomena is that which is not empty of impermanence, which means something that is not permanent, okay, or something that is impermanent, but they express it as this double negative, that which is not empty of impermanence, in accordance with the mode of proof. So it's an is statement, in the proof of sound as an impermanent phenomena. So anything that is an impermanent phenomenon is a member of the similar class in the proof of sound as an impermanent phenomena. So the criteria of proof referred to here is the mode of being, or the copulative mode. In other words, it's an is statement, okay, or an is proof. It's not an exist statement or an exist proof. For the sample syllogism seeks to show that sound is an impermanent phenomena as opposed to the exists mode of proof. Thus, in accordance with the mode of proof for the, all things which are not empty of impermanence, that is, are impermanent phenomena, are members of the similar class. So that includes matter, consciousness, the cats, the dogs, the occupancy permit, the snowblower, your frustration when something doesn't work properly, the person you don't like, democracy, all those things are included in the similar class. In impermanent phenomena. Now, what's interesting is all the things that fall under that category of impermanent phenomena, some of those things may be opposite to each other. Love and hate are both impermanent phenomena, but love and hate each other in relationship to each other are, totally contradictory. Okay, so if we say democracy is an impermanent phenomena, it does not mean that autocracy is not an impermanent phenomena simply because democracy and autocracy are opposites. Okay? The signs being the forward privation in the proof of something refers to its being, its relating to the similar class in a certain way. For example, the definition of something's being the forward privation in the proof of sound as an impermanent phenomena is that which is ascertained as existing exclusively in the similar class in the proof of sound as an impermanent phenomena. Okay, the stuff in parentheses is reminding us that of the requirement that this syllogism is for somebody who's interested in knowing something more about sound and understands this second criteria. Okay? But it's very bulky saying all of that stuff. But so often in the debates and so on, you have to put all of that stuff in, otherwise the statement appears too general and they will call you on making a generalist statement that doesn't apply to the particular here. Okay. So in order for a sign to be a forward privation, it must exist exclusively in the similar class. That is, it must be found exclusively in the similar class. Okay. Which means that it can't be found in the dissimilar class. Exclusively, I found it must exist exclusively in the similar class. Well, you know, when I first read that, I said, but the sign product can be the it can pertain to lots of different classes of phenomena. That's not the meaning here of existing exclusively. What it means is that this sign, that the reason pertains only to the similar class. It doesn't pertain to the dissimilar class. So product, you know, if it's a product, it's necessarily impermanent. And it is never permanent, okay? It doesn't have anything to do with the dissimilar class of permanent. Okay, that's what the exclusively means here. Otherwise, you know, when I first read it, I was going, okay. So in the sample syllogism, this means that product or productness, if you will, must exist exclusively among impermanent phenomena. According to the tenets of all Buddhists, this is so because there are no products that are not impermanent phenomena. Okay. Saying that there's no products that are not impermanent phenomena is the counterprivation. Okay. Yeah. So the heart of the definition of forward privation, and so this, if we take it back to our circles, what this means is that the circle that is the reason, it must be either within the bigger circle that is the predicate or concurrent, equivalent to the bigger circle that's impermanent. It can never be, the circle of the reason can never be bigger than the circle of the predicate, and it can never be intersecting. Remember? Yeah? It can never be intersecting like that. Okay, the heart of the definition of forward privation is that the sign is ascertained as existing exclusively in the similar class. The requirement of ascertainment serves to eliminate a doubtful cognition or an uncertain cognition. What's an example of a doubtful cognition in this example? Okay, in the example, sound is impermanent because it's a product. What would be a doubtful doubt pertaining to the reason?
There might be some sound that might be permanent?
That would be in relationship to the property. Okay.
That there might be some products that are not.
Yeah, that there might be some products that are not impermanent. You know, are all products really impermanent? I don't know. There could be some product, maybe, that is permanent. Yeah. Okay. Like how we feel sometimes, like, yeah, I change, but really I'm unchangeable. Yeah. Maybe something like that. Or, or an uncertain cognition. So, yeah, doubtful, uncertain, yeah. Or it could be the requirement of ascertainment also means that it can't be that the person can't have the wrong view that the sign is the opposite, is a member of the dissimilar class. Okay, so again, if somebody holds that there are products that are permanent, that may not be a doubtful thing of, well, maybe, it may be somebody's wrong view, then that sign, that reason, is not going to be a correct reason in that syllogism for that person, because that person can't ascertain that everything that is a product is necessarily impermanent. Yeah? Okay. Okay, so the sign is the forward privation only for a person who realizes definitely that the sign exists exclusively among members of the similar class and not members of the dissimilar class. Again, epistemological verification is required as a component of validity. That the sign must exist in the similar class serves to eliminate contradictory reasons. Okay, so not only doubtful reasons, but the example that I gave is a contradictory reason. Okay, for example, in the syllogism, the subject sound is a permanent phenomena because of being a product. Okay, or you could say the subject sound is an impermanent phenomena because of not being a product. Okay, so somehow there's some contradiction between there's not a privation between the reason and the predicate. Here, the sign product does not exist at all in the similar class of permanent phenomena, for it exists exclusively in the dissimilar class of impermanent phenomena, or perhaps non-permanent phenomena. If being the property of the subject were the only requirement of a correct sign, then you could validly prove sound to be a permanent phenomena by the sign of being a product. Okay? So if you only had to fulfill one criteria, which is the reason being the property of the subject, then that would be a great syllogism for somebody, you know, sound is a permanent phenomena because of being a product. Yeah, sound's a product. You know, it only requires one of the things, one criteria. So, yeah, it's a correct syllogism. But you need three, not one. However, since a correct sign must be the forward privation, and the forward privation requires that the sign must exist in the similar class, such a proof could never be valid. So he gave an example here, you know, sound is permanent because of being a product. Yeah. And I gave the example, sound is impermanent because of not being a product. Yeah. And so neither one of those would be valid arguments. Moreover, a correct sign must exist exclusively in the similar class and cannot be present in the dissimilar class. The dissimilar class in the proof of sound as an impermanent phenomena includes the class of permanent phenomena. The requirement in the definition of forward privation that the reason must exist exclusively in the similar class serves to eliminate indefinite reasons. For example, in the syllogism, the subject sound is an impermanent phenomena because of being an existent. So that's an indefinite reason, because the property holds, yeah, being an existent is a property of sound. But if it's an existent, is it necessarily an impermanent phenomena? No. So what would your circles be like in this one between impermanent phenomena and existent? You're saying existent is big and impermanent is a smaller one inside of it. Yeah, they wouldn't be intersecting, overlapping like that. Okay, and they wouldn't be equivalent. Okay, here the reason existent exists not only in the similar class as a quality of impermanent phenomena, but also in the dissimilar class as a quality of permanent phenomena, for both permanent and impermanent phenomena are equally existence. Thus, the definition of forward privation provides that the reason must exist exclusively in the similar class. So this is interesting, you know, to kind of try and be aware of throughout the day when, you know, we're working together and we give each other reasons for why something should be done in a certain way. Yeah? And, you know, and this is how we should test it out. Yeah? To see if the reasons are actually, yeah. Okay. So we'll take my example syllogism of cups in the cupboard as the subject should be put upside down is the predicate because it keeps the dirt out. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. The cup, keeping the dirt out, you know, keeping the dirt out of the cup, is that a property of the cup? You know, because it, how would we word it?
Keeps them clean.
Okay, so being clean could be a property of a cup. Okay. Now, if it's clean, is it necessarily, if the cup is clean, is it necessarily put in the cupboard upside down?
No.
Why not? Because you could what?
You could put a dirty cup in the cupboard upside down.
You could do that. Or you could put a right side up cup. And yeah. So being clean, being a clean cup in a cupboard is not necessarily exclusively. The similar class is upside down cups. But being a clean cup does not belong exclusively to the class of upside down cups. It could also belong to the class of right side up cups. Okay.
That's the trough we have right now. I find often cups with honey.
So, you know, this is very interesting. When we have our own internal syllogism about how something should be done, to check, is that a valid syllogism? Similar for the person who says, you know, the reason is, because it's right side up. Yeah. So if it's right side up, we made the cup in the cupboard is clean because it is upside down, and the cup in the cupboard is clean because it is right side up. Are either in either one of those, does the reason hold?
It's a property of the subject.
Well, it could be the property of the subject because a cup could be right side up, a cup could be upside down in both of those syllogisms. But in those syllogisms, is being right side up a quality of being clean? No. Is being upside down a quality of being clean? No. So when we realize this, then why do we hold so strongly to our way of thinking of how the cup should be put in the cupboard? Because our syllogism, is incorrect. Okay? So this is very, very helpful. You know, we're trying, you know, because when we don't examine our own personal syllogisms and we just think that our reason is necessarily belongs exclusively to the similar class and we don't check it well, then we could be ascertaining something incorrectly, which disproves our whole syllogism. And yet we will quarrel with other people because we are grasping on to our own incorrect syllogism. Okay? So are we willing to create negative karma that will send us to the hell realm or animal realm or preto realm because we're clinging to an incorrect syllogism? Apparently we are. So sentient beings are foolish because they cling to incorrect syllogism. Okay. So sentient beings do is what sentient beings do. But, you know, if we're all supposedly trying to get ourselves out of samsara, do we want to continue to cling to incorrect syllogisms? No. Do we want to fight with other people because we're clinging to our own incorrect syllogism?
Yes. No.
Okay? So this is really good, you know, to stop and look, because so often in the disagreements we have is we have our own internal syllogism and we haven't checked out the three criteria about our own syllogism. Okay? Similarly, when we disparage ourselves and criticize ourselves, we're holding on to an incorrect syllogism, but we're not checking out if we're, you know, because we're not seeing if the reason is the three criteria, again, we hold on to an incorrect syllogism that disparages ourselves, that makes more obstacles for us progressing on the path. So again, do we really want to cling to incorrect syllogisms? Or is it better for us to bring these incorrect syllogisms to a conscious level and then check them out and see, do they hold or are they a bunch of... Okay? Yeah. So this is important because if we can do this, it will prevent so many arguments. It will prevent us from having so much frustration. Because you know how frustrated we get when other people don't agree with our way of doing things? And it makes us so unhappy. So we could prevent all that frustration, all that unhappiness, by looking at the way we're constructing arguments and clinging on to wrong reasons. Yeah. This is why His Holiness emphasizes the importance of using reasoning. Mm-hmm. You hear Him over and over again, don't you, in teachings? Again and again, He says, we've got to use reasoning.
I'm thinking that maybe this week, if we get in a disagreement with somebody or have a difference of opinion, we could note it and then later write down the syllogism that mm-hmm. we were thinking and mm-hmm. then maybe present it next
yeah.
week.
Yeah. Or even stop right there and each person try and, you know, write down their own syllogism. And it's good practice because it'll make us think, like with this you know, upside down cup, the first way I formulated it wasn't a good way to formulate a syllogism. So this would also be very good practice on how to formulate syllogisms.
Could I reformulate that?
Mm-hmm.
If storing a cup upside down, it keeps the dust from settling in the cup.
That's not a syllogism.
No, it's not. But how would you, well, it's this, it keeps the cup clean because it keeps the dust from settling in the cup.
Mm-hmm.
Keeps the inside of the cup clean.
Yeah, it keeps the inside. But then the other person would say, holding it right side up keeps the cup clean because the bottom of the cupboard may be dirty, and if you put it upside down, then the rim where people put their lips could get full of dirt and germs.
Keeps the rim of the cup clean. So,
yeah, but both of them...
They could both be true syllogisms. You just have to...
If you specify what part of the cup. But both of them, you know, the purpose is to keep us healthy. Yeah, so it doesn't really matter whether we talk about the inside of the cup or the rim of the cup, because if either one of those is dirty, somebody could get sick.
Yeah, if they come out of the dishwasher, the dishwater looking bad to begin with.
Yeah.
But, you know, okay. Well, I guess what I was thinking is that both syllogisms could be correct, and we're just thinking about which aspect is most important. The rim or the inside.
Yeah, but we have to, if we put the syllogism as the cup in the cupboard is clean and will not make somebody sick, yeah, because it is, you know, so you have to make the syllogism clear what you're meaning, yeah. Clean means the whole cup, or okay. Clean means not having germs on it or dirt on it. Okay. So it's, you know, it comes up all the time. You know, somebody may be doing something one way and, you know, somebody is carrying Mudita over to the cabin and they just have her on the shoulder. And I go, put Mudita inside your jacket. You know, and the other person goes, why? She's perfectly okay outside my jacket. I go, no, she's got to be inside the jacket because that way she's more comfortable, or that way she stops shivering. And the other person says, but she's not shivering outside my jacket, so leave me alone. I'm just walking from here to the cabin, you know. And we get in a big thing with somebody else about whether to carry the cat inside our jacket or outside the jacket. Yeah? Okay? So let's test that. Yeah? So what are we trying to get across? We're trying to keep the cat what? Keep the cat healthy, aren't we? Or keep the cat happy?
Warm.
Warm and dry. Okay. Okay. So the cat is warm and dry because of being carried
inside
the jacket. Wait, no, we can't have just both warm and dry. The cat is warm and comfortable being carried inside the jacket.
Well, I can't have one in dry, but one in comfortable.
Yeah, because the cat can be comfortable because the cat will be warm and dry inside the jacket, but the cat can be warm and comfortable outside the jacket too. And the cat can be warm and uncomfortable inside the jacket.
It follows, therefore, that anytime we carry the cat, it's raining.
Yeah, so we have to specify in the rain. Okay.
Yeah. It sounds like what you're trying to prove is that it's better to carry her inside the jacket. So that would have to be the predicate.
Yeah.
Take Mudita, it's better to carry her inside your jacket between my cottage and...
Yeah. No, what I'm trying to show is that two people can have two different syllogisms, but neither one of them hold if you examine correctly, like the cup syllogism. Yeah. So one person's having the syllogism. The cat is warm and comfortable because of being carried inside the jacket. And another person is saying the cat is warm, who cares warm, but is uncomfortable because of being carried inside the jacket. And that person's also saying the cat is warm and comfortable being outside the jacket because it's not that cold.
She has a lot of fur.
Yeah, she has a lot of fur. So, yeah. So what I'm trying to show is that there's two people who both have incorrect syllogisms. Yeah, and so they're arguing over what do you put the cat inside the jacket or outside the jacket. But, you know, both of their syllogisms are incorrect. Yeah, because the cat could be outside the jacket and be warm and comfortable. And the cat could also be outside the jacket, be warm and uncomfortable. The cat can be inside the jacket, be warm and comfortable, or can be warm and uncomfortable. Yeah? So we shouldn't fight over how to carry the cat. Okay? Because it's just going to make us, you know, kind of, not. And, you know, we have this kind of argument over something like this. You know, that's so incredibly important in the state of humanity, of the planet and the universe right now, about how to carry the cat. But we're clinging to our wrong syllogism, and somebody else has another syllogism that they're clinging to, which we know is wrong. And therefore, we draw the conclusion that that person is an obnoxious person. And then we draw another conclusion that, therefore, I will never get along with them. And then we draw another conclusion, therefore, I will stay away from them because they always drive me crazy. And so based on disagreeing about how to carry the cat, we don't speak to another community member and we avoid them whenever we see them.
We started with real wolf. Mm-hmm.
So look what we do to ourselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we're not even checking out if we're right and if they're wrong. And we also say if they're wrong, they're bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's another syllogism. Somebody is wrong. Somebody is bad because they're wrong. Okay? So in some situation, you know, even if they are wrong, but here we're talking about both people having wrong syllogism. But even if somebody is wrong, does it pervade that if you're wrong, you're bad? Is that a correct pervasion? No. But we think it's true. Anybody who's wrong is bad. Anybody who's bad, I should avoid. Yeah. Or anybody who is bad, will harm me. Anybody who will harm me, I should avoid. You see, this whole series, you can go back afterwards, write down one syllogism after the other. And so we come to the conclusion of, well, I'm just not going to talk to that person in the community. Yeah, that's the best way to protect myself, because they're an awful person, because they're bad, and they're bad because they're wrong, and they're wrong because they carry the cat in a different... Yeah.
When they don't agree with me.
Yeah, because they don't agree with me on how to carry the cat. Really? You know? And we think we are intelligent people. Is that a sign of intelligence?
Yeah.
Huh? It's a stupidaggio, isn't it? It's not the sign of an intelligent living being. So this is the kind of thing that we need to catch in our mind. Yeah? When we are being foolish sentient beings, because there's always these syllogisms, these arguments going on in our mind that are totally ridiculous, that make us suffer so much. It's sad, isn't it? Yeah. That's why I say here the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they're so desperately trying to drag us to awakening with all their might. And we're clinging on to that person is bad because they're wrong, and they're wrong because they carry the cat outside the jacket, or because they carry the cat at all, or because they won't carry the cat, or because of who knows what reason. We can make up a ton of reasons why somebody is wrong. And then they're wrong. Somebody is bad because they're wrong. Somebody is not to be trusted because they're bad. Somebody is to be avoided because they're not to be trusted.
Ignorance.
Dig ourselves into a hole. It's ignorance, isn't it?
Very thick ignorance.
Very, very thick ignorance. And you look at us, we do it every day, don't we? Yeah. It's really rather humbling to see this. Yeah. So it's good, you know, check up on a day-to-day basis and write down some of your syllogisms, and then learn to laugh at how foolish your ignorant mind can be. Yeah. When you look at some of the syllogisms you make and you see how illogical they are, that they don't have the three criteria, then learn to laugh. Don't get down on yourself, but laugh.
I think with the syllogism, they're bad because they're wrong, it made me think it's really important to look at what thoughts we have about ourselves, because we often learn as a young child, I'm bad because I'm wrong. Because you're wrong, you get into trouble, so then you internalize that. If you've internalized that, then of course that's how you're going to view other people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and because your comment that we're conditioned to think that people who are wrong are bad. So it's so important to see what we think about ourselves, because that's just gonna.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the two go together. The syllogisms about self and about others. Yeah. But it's also this thing of showing us how, when we become familiar with something, even though it's totally dysfunctional, we cling to it simply out of familiarity. And something could be true and liberating, but we're frightened of it simply because it's unfamiliar.
Like with this kind of wrong syllogism, you can then justify to yourself why it's okay to cut off the arm of a child.
Oh, yeah. You can justify anything with wrong syllogisms. Yeah, and that's what people do. I mean,
these people are worthy to be killed because they are infidels. Yeah. These people should not have equal rights because of the color of their skin, their gender, their sexual orientation, their race, their ethnicity, their religion, whatever you want to put it. You know, these are the syllogisms that people make up to justify all sorts of atrocious things.
Proof of what is liberating is not always self-evident. Like, I've been thinking a lot about the, like, you know, it works for my mind to meditate on the parts of the body to establish its foulness. But as a syllogism, it doesn't work that way, right? The body is foul because it is dependent on parts. There's no pervasion.
No, there's, yeah, that's not, dependent on parts is not a correct reason.
Yeah. So what is the correct reason there? The body is foul because its parts are foul?
The body is foul because it is made of, you know, dirty things.
Yeah, that's what I came down to in the end. And then you look at each part, so it is just foul on its own.
Yeah. I mean, you look, it's composed of foul things. So you start looking, you know, how gorgeous is your stomach? Mm-hmm. How gorgeous is your esophagus? How gorgeous is your blood pouring on the asphalt?
Your earwax.
Your earwax, yeah. You know, whatever it is. So, yeah, then you examine those things in your meditation and you see that they're all kind of ugh. And so then, yeah, the body is foul. The body is unattractive. Yeah, because it's composed of these kinds of things. So here, actually, this is a good way, a good point to point this out, is that you can use a syllogism, but a syllogism meets back to experience. So somebody may teach you the body is foul and to examine all the parts of the body. They may not put it in a syllogistic form, but if you meditate well, your understanding becomes a syllogism because you come to understand that the body is foul because it's made of foul things, and you understand the body is made of foul things because you've done the mindfulness of the body meditation, and you've seen that, okay? So your teacher may not have put the understanding as a syllogism, but if you meditate correctly, you're going to come to that. Another teacher may teach you the body is foul because it's made of these things, yeah, dirty things. But to really understand that, you have to do some meditation and see that the body is made of those dirty things. And if it's made of dirty things, then it is foul. So this is a good example of how meditation and reasoning have to come together. Whether you start out with meditating and draw a syllogism as the conclusion, or you start out with the syllogism and you meditate in order to gain the proof. Yeah? So they come together. So I think this is especially important to understand, because some people come to Buddhism and they say, oh, well, I was studying with a Theravada teacher that said to meditate like this, da-da-da-da-da, and somebody else says, well, I just came from the, you know, the Tibetan tradition, and they said, you know, gave me this syllogism, and so the syllogism is just all intellectual. How are you going to gain any understanding from that, says one person. And the other person says, well, you're just sitting there, you know, looking at all these things in your body. What are you going to understand from that? And that's because, you know, neither of those people are realizing that the two have to come together, yeah, for somebody to have an actual realization.
And two, the meditation method exists within the context of the Buddhist worldview and teachings. right? The meditation method exists within the worldview and teachings too, because I was thinking of how hard we struggled with just this in that first month of the Four Establishments retreat. There were people who were like, the body is a magnificent creation because it is dependent on parts that work so well together. And I was like, how do we come to that?
Yeah.
Or people who refuse to just accept, you know, the hair is beautiful.
Yeah, the body's beautiful, right. And one of the reasons is, you know, the body's not foul, the body's beautiful because look how it functions together so magnificently. But functioning magnificently together, first of all, does the body always function magnificently? No. So there's no, there's not the first criteria. Second of all, if it functions magnificently, is it necessarily beautiful? No, because you could have a war machine that functions magnificently and it's certainly not beautiful. Okay? So, you know, again, examples of incorrect syllogisms that prevent us from seeing things as they are. You know, because we're holding on to very strong wrong ideas. Yeah? And we're not willing to question our own ideas. And I think that's one of the big things, you know, to be a Dharma practitioner. We have to be able to question everything. 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 Yeah. I received this very beautiful letter from an inmate. Did I tell you about this? I should really read this letter that he wrote. It's somebody who's been in prison since he was probably about 18, 19 on a charge of, you know, an accessory to a murder or something like that. So he doesn't have a life sentence, but he's in for a really long time. So we have very interesting discussions, but I asked him, you know, tell me more about your life. And he said, well, I've told you many of the things from when I was a kid, you know, but since I've been imprisoned, there's not much to tell you by looking on the outside, because if you walk up and down this tier and you look in everybody's room, you're likely to see somebody sitting on a bunk, either reading a book or looking at television. And that's your whole life, you know. So on the outside, you know, all of our lives look pretty much the same. But he says, I'm reading a book. What was he reading? Something about Taoism, I think, Taoistic philosophy or something, you know. He said, but I'm reading this book and thinking about what it means, you know. And of course, we know that other people are reading sci-fi or detective stories or who knows what. You know, and so what he did was he opened the door of, you know, if you want to know about my life, it's not about what I do, because I basically sit on this bunk most of the day. But if you want to know about my life, you have to know about what I think. And then in telling me about, you know, the richness of his inner life, he said, many years ago when he was still young, he was in prison by this time, but he saw a work of art that had the world there, and it was an old, decrepit, yucky world, and it was split open, but out of it was coming a new, beautiful planet. So, you know, the old yucky planet, and out of it was the new planet. And he said that piece of art just made him stop and say, that's my life. What I've been doing until now has been this old yucky planet, you know, and I have to do something to make a new beautiful planet come out of it. And so he said he started questioning his life, and he started with his music. Why do I listen to the music that I listen to? Yeah. Is this music benefiting me? How is it making me think? What does it make arise in me? So he started just questioning the music he listened to. Then he started questioning the TV programs he watched. Then he started questioning all sorts of different things about his life. You know, his drug use, his relationship with his parents, his relationship with authority, all these different things. And he said that he realized that, you know, in order to become this new planet coming out of the old one, he had to call into question everything about his life. Yeah? This is somebody who had not met the Dharma. Yeah? So, yeah. So this is what we have to do as practitioners, is question all these things and look at all the quote-quote syllogisms, many of which are incorrect, that we hold on to so tenaciously. So we can look at all sorts of things. And you know, we have to learn how to make the syllogism correct. So I'm just throwing some things out. But we could be saying to ourselves, you know, I have to work. I have to work as much as possible so that I deserve to be here. Yeah. Or so you want to put that in a correct syllogistic form. You know, I deserve to be here because I work nonstop. Yeah? So, okay, you know, working nonstop is a product, is a property of the subject. But does working nonstop, is that essential for being deserving of living here? Yes, it would. It would exclude all the cats. But they would say, we work hard at being adorable. Therefore, we deserve to live here. Somebody would else say, no, you don't work hard at being adorable. Yeah. Okay. So to look at these kinds of things that we tell ourselves that feed how we act. So your homework for this week, yeah, is, yeah, come up with some of the syllogisms that, you know, and write it in a correct syllogistic form, which means, like I said, wording it properly, of something that you disagreed with somebody else about. Okay? It could be how to plow the road. It could be when to send an email. Who knows? Okay? Some one of these really crucial things. And then also come up with another syllogism about how you, about something deeper, about how you see the world, how you see yourself, or how you, what your rules are for how people are, or how they should be. Okay.
So the rules of the universe are mostly incorrect syllogisms.
Yeah. Yeah. The subject I, yeah, should be liked by everybody because I said so. Yeah. Or the subject I, you know, should be liked by everybody because otherwise I'm going to fall apart. Or, you know, see what you're telling yourself. And you may have to play with it to get it in a correct syllogistic form. Okay. Okay, so where are we ending here? Okay, we're ending right before the tabby cat. Okay. So the subject sound is an impermanent phenomena because of being a product. The sign and the similar class are equal in extent. All products are impermanent phenomena, and all impermanent phenomena are products. There is nothing that is one, but not the other. Okay, and then we'll start next week talking about tabby cats.